Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome this hour. We are about to have a conversation with Congressman John Sarbanes. On the way there, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Mortgage Program, a community lending initiative of the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. If you are a first or second home, first or second home buyer, let me get that out right, and you want to buy a house in the city of Baltimore, there may be homes for you. 1-800-638-7781, the Maryland Mortgage Program. Let me see if I can do better than that in my conversation with Congressman John Sarbanes, who represents the 3rd Congressional District, and good to have you in the studio.
Thanks. Good to be here, Mark.
So let's begin, before we get into the meat of, folks, the lines are open at 410-319-8888. Any political question you have, social issue facing our country, what's facing us in foreign affairs, what's facing Congress, your thoughts about Congress, about questions you want to know about what's happening in the U.S. Congress, please join us at 410-319-8888 as you spend the next hour with Congressman John Sarbanes. I just want to lay out, before we get into the heart of what the problem is in America, this new effort that you have, not that new, it's been going on for a while now, to take the money out of politics by starting with your own campaign.
Well, what we tried to do, Mark, was you're looking at a situation now where the democracy is drowning in money. And when I say that, I mean it's really in peril because you have these special interests that have a lot of money. They're pouring it into campaigns. They've created a situation in Washington where there's a heavy dependence by members of Congress on this special interest money because campaigns cost so much. That's the way it was even before the Citizens United case. What's happened since then is because these super PACs are out there and they can throw millions of dollars into races. We've seen it at the presidential level. Stay tuned as they begin to train their focus on congressional races. Because they can put all this money in and do it at the last minute, it exposes members of Congress and other candidates, frankly, to the situation where you can be overwhelmed on the airwaves with these independent expenditures and so forth. You have no way of fighting back. And when I looked at that, I decided, you know, we've got to have a different model. We've got to figure out a way that the average rank-and-file member of Congress can fight back against that kind of outside influence. And the way you do it is you build what I call a grassroots donor network. So this is a network of people who give, you know, $5, $10, $15, $50, let's say under $100. But if you build a broad enough base of people who have that interest and willingness to help underwrite campaigns, they've got your back if a super PAC comes after you, and you can actually push back. And the beauty of it is the person who's giving $25 or $15 is not asking for special favors.
Right.
What they want you to do is go do your job. And so if they have your back, it's really the public that has your back. And it means when you go to Washington, you'll be better armed to push for legislation that's in the public interest instead of having to lean towards these special interests, which have become the chief source of financing of campaigns. So what I did in my campaign was I said, look, I want to model public financing. And some of the models that are out there, one in particular, the Fair Elections Now Act, says that if a candidate can go recruit a certain number of grassroots donors, say 1,000 or 1,500 people, people who give less than $100, then they'll be rewarded by getting access to dollars from a public fund. So it's a way to encourage candidates to broaden their appeal to the public at large, and then they get a benefit from that, from a public fund. It's not law. But I said, let me try it anyway. So I went to traditional donors. These are people who tend to give a lot of money. And I said, if you'll help me raise $500,000, I'll pledge to you to put that off limits, set it aside in my campaign, and I won't touch it till I go recruit 1,000 grassroots donors. So we can show that this model will work and start to demonstrate the power of grassroots financing. So that's what we've been doing. It's very exciting.
How's it working?
It's working. It's not easy, though. I mean, you're not running for president here. I mean, when you're running for president, when you're Barack Obama and so forth, or Howard Dean or whatever, you get that viral tipping point going online, and you get those online surges of grassroots donors. If you're a rank-and-file member who's running, you got to really work at it. You got to build it systematically. But what you have in place when you're done is something that's very sturdy, something you can turn to when you need it and activate it on behalf of the public. And that's very appealing.
So two things I was thinking about. Folks, join us here at 410-319-8888. We're talking about money and politics. We're talking about a bunch of other issues. But I'm curious to see your thoughts on that for Congressman Sarbanes and what you think of this idea he's doing. 410-319-8888. This in some ways is akin to, or is it akin to, the federal model that some people propose, which is public financing of elections. So if a candidate raises X amount of money, it's matched by the government? Is that part of what this model is about?
Yeah, this is basically to mimic what a public financing system would look like. And when you talk about public financing, you're basically saying that candidates that meet certain criteria, and the criteria we want to set is you go out and raise money from the grassroots. Other things I'd like to see, you agree not to accept PAC contributions. You agree not to accept bundled contributions.
But you don't.
Correct. Which are some of the other things that have kind of infected our politics. And by the way, I don't pass judgment on my colleagues because a lot of them are in very difficult frontline races. And, you know, they've got to raise a ton of money for their campaign. They have to do it instantly. So they become dependent on some of these sources of campaign funding. But a public financing model says that the public will step up and basically lift the democracy onto its own shoulders when it comes to campaign financing. And so you create these opportunities for matching funds. For example, I'm going to be introducing some legislation soon that would say that for every $1 you raise from the grassroots as a candidate, you get a 5-to-1 match from a public fund that is created. And that's a way for the public to step up and say, we'll be responsible for financing campaigns instead of letting the special interests be responsible for it. Because if you let them be responsible, you know, you can predict what's going to happen. Legislation starts getting made in their favor instead of in favor of the public.
So 2 years ago, Citizens United and the case for the Supreme Court, what was one of the things that broke the back of this whole effort to make more public the financing of elections. And so do we need to go as far, and some people think we do, as saying that we should not allow corporate funding of elections, that maybe even unions, people should be out of it. It should be between the public dollars, matching candidates' race dollars from their constituents, and that's how we want to race. I mean, is that where we need to be?
I think Congress certainly ought to be able to regulate campaign finance in a more robust way. And what the Citizens United case is, it basically wiped away Congress's ability to do that because you have a Supreme Court now that, based on this notion, for example, of corporate personhood, you know, and the idea that corporations should have the same rights of free speech as an individual human person ought to have. They've taken it way too far, I think. They've removed Congress's ability, as it had done, for example, under the McCain-Feingold Act, to impose some reasonable limits on corporate spending and campaigns. And as a result now, you've got these corporations and billionaires and others through the super PAC mechanism are jumping into campaigns. You know, Sheldon Adelson is this fellow who's perfectly proud to wave a flag and say, yeah, I've dropped $21 million into the presidential election on the Republican side. But there's a lot of people like him that are hiding behind this curtain where you can't see them. There's lack of transparency, but they're pouring millions of dollars in. And it's going to get to the point, Mark, I mean, I'm only slightly exaggerating this, where instead of owning sports teams, these billionaires will decide to own their own members of Congress.
But some people argue that's happening at the moment. I mean, we have had shows in the Hill, and we'll get to the phones here, 410-319-8888. Maria and Eric, your first caller is up. We'll come to you in a second. Is that we had a show yesterday. Was it yesterday? It all fog sometimes. On mountaintop removal. And they're bringing a film to Baltimore, and these were activists in West Virginia. And one of the pieces in the film talked about President George Bush when he won, saying this was a coal power fired election because the coal industry boosted him over the top in terms of money and put him into, helped put him into office. And that they're saying that all of our congressmen in West Virginia are all in favor of mountaintop removal because they've been supported by coal. And you can go there, and it goes, I mean, it happens in so many places. And
let me put it this way. For the most part, I don't think that members of Congress act in a conscious quid pro quo transactional way when it comes to where their campaign dollars come from. But as a practical matter, if you have an institution that, in the words of Lawrence Lessig, who's written about that, is increasingly dependent on big special interest money, then over time what happens is that institution starts to lean in the direction of those special interests as it makes policy. And the only way you're going to stop that from happening, and therefore the only way you're going to be able to make progress on things the public wants to see, education and health care and environmental concerns are the one you mentioned, is if you deal with the real problem in the middle of the room, which is the way campaigns get financed. And if I know that the public will be out there to support me the next time I'm running a campaign in terms of the funding of the campaign, I can be more independent when I'm in Washington and voting on legislation. Because the human tendency is where you create a dependency, you tend to answer more to the people that you're dependent upon, and you lean away, in this case, from the public that's looking to you to defend their interests.
And it happens in so many arenas. It's in every arena you can think of. I mean, we had a show recently about the power of AIPAC, which I think limits conversations people have on the Middle East and Israel and the future of a Palestinian state. I mean, all the, because of the power of that money that's inside this discussion. So discussions are controlled.
And the money's the thing, because, look, I don't have any reason to say that a lobbyist who wants to come to my office and, you know, make points on their issue shouldn't be able to do that. You know, the more the merrier. People coming in and telling you what they think is part of your sort of doing your homework as you approach legislation. What becomes corrosive is when the people that walk into your office are also the same people that you're highly dependent upon for the dollars to fund your campaigns.
Right.
And it also creates an imbalance because, you know, there's a lot of nonprofit organizations out there who want to come in and get your attention, but they may not be able to generate the same kind of campaign support
right.
in terms of funding as, you know, some big industry like the oil and gas industry or something like that. So you end up with this imbalance, which then affects in turn the way public policy gets made, and that's not good for the country, and that's why we've got to fix this problem head on.
Let's go to the phones at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts, Eric's the first caller up, then we go to Marcia. 410-319-8888. Congressman John Sarbanes is with us. We're going to cover a number of topics. We're talking about campaign finance. Many people think that the power of the corporate dollar are destroying not just our political system, our political races, but are a danger to our democracy itself. 410-319-8888. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi, John. This is Eric Knowles. I'm your Republican candidate in your competition this year. And I was saying I kind of like what you're saying, but I think we ought to start now, and we can cap this off at a $50,000 raise to start off with. I think that'll really level the playing field. But I kind of have some difference with what you're saying as well. You're talking about a public financing fund, but isn't that basically the same thing as a super PAC, except there's less freedom of choice now, or more options, which, you know, options are freedom and freedoms are options to us, but now we have just the government that now controls the purse strings for the campaigns there. Don't you think that's kind of a dangerous road to go down for one? And then I shudder to think that the fact that I would be forced then by the government to pay my taxes towards something that I don't necessarily agree with, like another person's campaign. That money, I don't know if my money is going to be separated to go to people that I like anymore, as opposed to just kind of thrown in one big pot with your idea that you have here and just given out to people that I wouldn't, and people and ideas that I just wouldn't necessarily be behind.
Well, on the first point of, you know, isn't this just like another super PAC? In one sense it is, but it's kind of America's super PAC. It's you know, average people stepping up, and through contributions of $10 or $15 or $50, they're the ones that are creating the power to push back on a super PAC culture that's essentially financed by private special interests, many of them which are hidden away from view. So if you want to look at it that way, call it America's super PAC or the super PAC for the people or whatever it is, that to me is what a public financing fund is all about. In terms of how you raise that money, I think there's a lot of ways you can do it that aren't forcing anybody to do anything. So, for example, right now a lot of these super PACs are making contributions that are not taxed because they're masquerading as charitable contributions. Well, if we enforce, you know, if we get the IRS to really crack down and enforce what the rules are with respect to what's really a gift versus some other kind of contribution, then there'd be a tax on a lot of those gifts that are being made. So you're talking about taxing super PACs, and that's a source of money I'd like to see that could go into creating this fund. You can have a voluntary checkoff. We do that for presidential races now. We don't have that option for congressional races, but that's where somebody on their tax return could say, yeah, I want to put $3 towards this, you know, democracy fund that's being created to help support public financing. So there's ways to fund this that don't significantly add to the taxpayer's burden, but I think create an alternative to the way the money is sourced right now. And it gets us back to where we are free of this tremendous influence that the super PACs and the special interests and the corporate interests have on our public policy system right now.
Eric, thanks for the call, and we'll look forward to talking to you as the race heats up down the road. Thank you for being part of the show. We will do that. 410-319-8888, and Marcia, you're on the air.
Yeah, I just wanted to comment on Eric's comment, and it just highlights my concerns. He seems to think that that's a problem, but there's no problem with no tax on capital gain. Corporate America has so much control over what is done in Washington. I can remember, I'm 59 years old, I can remember when Mr. Sarbanes' father came to our house to campaign when he was running for election. And it's so out of hand now. It's only big money, not the people who want to see civic duties exercised and schools better and the roads better, those kind of things. The people that want that have no power anymore. It's just corporate America. And I would love to see something like this. What's the difference between why not take the money in a fund that's given by the people willingly instead of corporate America mandating so that they can make more money? It's not being dispersed equally. At 59, I make $18,000 a year. $2,000 of my income goes to taxes, and I'm preparing to live in poverty with Social Security. Because they're already telling me that in 15 years they're not even going to be able to pay my Social Security. There's something really askew. You know, there's something wrong, and it has to be addressed. Or we're just going to be like all the countries that we looked down on 25 years ago that we thought were so horrible because they didn't take care of their people. And that's my comment. I hope that things improve for my children.
I appreciate
Marcia,
that,
thank you
Marcia.
So much.
You know, when you do surveys, you find that 80 or 85% of Americans think that we ought to tax hedge fund managers at the ordinary income tax rate.
Yeah, I'm one of those people.
Okay. we can't get that passed in Congress. And the reason for it is very simple. They have a lot of money. They have a lot of influence. They have a lot of power. And they can find a way to make sure that legislation that may start out drafted to make that change pretty soon gets marginalized. I mean, you got to understand the environment, Mark. There's a lot of things coming at members of Congress, right? So you have to sort of pick and choose where your attention span is going to be any given moment. So you may decide you're going to start out and you want to fix some corporate loophole that's there, that some industry is getting away with murder. But by the time they spin you around 50 times and remind you of, you know, how we've helped you here and how we helped you there, suddenly all that energy dissipates. You multiply that a time and time again, and you end up with an institution that's becoming increasingly incapable of processing the public's will and converting that into legislation that's in the public interest. And that's why you get the frustration, like we just heard from Marcia. And it's very sinister. What's going to start happening is the money that pours into politics isn't just going to be about getting majorities, which is kind of what it's been about the last few cycles. It's going to be about advancing a particular corporate agenda. And they may decide, well, we can't defeat this person, but if we throw $500,000 in against them, and they know that it's coming from our industry, then maybe the next time they're in that hearing, they won't ask such, you know, nosy questions about what we're doing. And so they're going to chill the whole process of open public discourse and debate. And that is the consequence of this big money being present in our politics. And the only way we free ourselves from it is if we come up with a system of public financing and grassroots financing of the kind that we're trying to explore right now in our campaign is a way to begin to model that.
John Sarbanes is with us. He's the 3rd District Congressman. 410-319-8888. His district extends from – your district is really ridiculous. It just goes – not ridiculous.
That's one word to describe the shape of it.
The shape
yes.
of it. Not the people
exactly.
in it, but the shape of it.
Yes.
410-319-8888. Rob in Baltimore County, you're on the air.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder, and also Mrs. Sarbanes for entertaining my comments. Basically, all I really want to say is I kind of want to go back to what Mr. Sarbanes had spoke about earlier with regards to the fact that, you know, like, I understand that they do not want, I'm pretty much alluding to, you know, a lot of the GOP conservatives and so forth, the so-called 1%. But I understand the rationale behind not wanting to tax, like, capital gains and investors and so forth at the same rate as you would, like, say, you know, income and so forth, or, like, regular, you know, income tax. Because I know they want to encourage, you know, investment. However, I think that what's happening with this country and what's been happening for years is the fact that, you know, you've got for the most part built-in corruption, so to speak. And I hate to lay such a broad brushstroke because when you think about the fact that most of Congress is made up of, you know, attorneys and so forth. I've always wondered, how is it that so many loopholes could exist with so many legal scholars and minds, you know, present? And it's done to me. It's purpose. It's on purpose. Because obviously, what you're dealing with people who are very well-versed, you know, in legalese, legal jargon and so forth. And therefore, you know, most common people, most the average Joe, who aren't very versed in legalese and so forth, they're completely clueless with regard to what most laws say. And so, really, you don't have a situation of have and have not. You have more of a situation of no and no not, in which basically the no not, which pretty much most of us who aren't graduates of any type of Jewish doctorate degrees, whatever, we're clueless as far as what's going on. And I think that the only true remedy to the inherent corruption that exists within Congress and in politics in general is, number one, the most obvious thing, you know, campaign, you know, finance reform. But also, I think you need to add on a few other things, such as term limits. I think that too often, you know, representatives, who even though they have the cycle every 2 years and so forth, you've got people there who are maybe there for 14, 15 different cycles, 20, 30 years. And at this point, they're not going to be as hungry for change as some freshmen coming in. I know that we had the latest freshman with the so-called Tea Party freshmen. But that's another thing I also want to say quickly is the fact that I think that another thing that would kind of cut down on the corruption would be some type of 5 or 10 year moratorium on any congressperson leaving to become a lobbyist. Because when you talk about the American dream,
right?
The American dream, as far as I'm concerned, is the American dream for politicians. Because once you're done with politicking, you can go ahead on into the private sector, become a lobbyist, and make millions of dollars. And for them, that's the American dream. But for the rest of us, that dream doesn't exist.
So it's the American nightmare.
Well,
but before you answer, John, Rob, we have to take a short break. So we're going to, as soon as we come back from the break, we're going to let you hear the answer to your questions about term limits, and not allowing congressmen to become lobbyists. Any other things you would ask Congressman Sarbanes? Then we'll go to Travis and Nancy. Our next two callers up, 410-319-8888. Congressman John Sarbanes of the 3rd Congressional District. He's our guest this hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. I'm here with 3rd District Congressman John Sarbanes, Democrat, 410-319-8888. Before we go back to the phones, you were going to answer Rob's questions.
Yeah, Rob raised a couple of things that I think merit some real attention. The first is this issue of, he alluded to kind of corruption. And as I said before, you know, this is not Rod Blagojevich kind of corruption that's going on for the most part in Congress. You know, it's not a kind of quid pro quo transactional thing.
But it is corruption. It's not illegal, but it's corrupt.
It's what Lawrence Lessig calls dependency corruption. It's institutional corruption. It's corrupting the institution because the institution becomes so dependent on special interest money that it can't see straight anymore. And so it can't really enact the public's will because it's so dependent. And that is a form of corruption, okay? And so that's a fair point to make. In terms of, you know, lobbyists who, you know, former members of Congress who go out to lobby, I mean, I agree that there ought to be some restrictions on that activity. And it's not just former members of Congress. You have a lot of staffers that come off the Hill and they go to work for K Street, which is the lobbying outfit in Maryland. That's where in Washington. That's where all the offices are located. But I was saying to you off the air, Mark, that if you could get the money out, you could even decrease that issue, because the reason those lobbyists can make so much money and therefore it's attractive for former members of Congress and staffers is because they can go to the Hill and they can get the ear of a member of Congress because there's a lot of money behind them.
Right.
And if those members were no longer as dependent on that big money and that, you know, corporate industry money to fund their campaigns because there was a public financing system in place, then those lobbyists wouldn't get as much traction on Capitol Hill and they wouldn't be able to pull down those huge salaries. So it all goes back to the phrase money is the root of all evil. If you look at what's wrong now with the system, it can be traced back to this influence of big money.
But he also asked a question about maybe term limits is part of the answer.
Well, you know, you get that question from time to time. And I understand the frustration over people who've been there for sort of a long time. They kind of get set in their ways. They're not as open to change. They're not as fresh in their thinking, perhaps. You know, my answer to that always is, if you're a member of the House of Representatives, you run every 2 years. And so that verdict gets exercised every 2 years as to whether you're up to the job or you're not up to the job. Now, in the same way that big money can defeat people, it can also protect people. So again, if you can create a public financing system that levels the playing field a little bit more, then somebody who's really out of touch, but a particular industry might want to protect them in Congress, maybe they don't have the same kind of traction, and you get the practical equivalent of a term limit being placed on that member because they're not connected to the public anymore and what the public wants to see. The other argument or sort of caution about arbitrary term limits is sometimes, you know, when I hear term limits, they're often, you know, 3 terms, 4 terms. That can be the amount of time it takes somebody to really understand how the institution functions and become effective, and then they're being sort of, you know, arbitrarily removed from their ability to help. So, again, I think it's better to leave it to the people to make that judgment every 2 years, but to have them make the judgment without the confusion that's created by the presence of big money in the process.
So before we get to Travis, Nancy Bernard, we're going to get to all 3 of your calls right here, but something you said during the break— when we talked about it would be impossible now for the United States Congress to pass a law mandating that you have to keep corporate money out of campaigns or mandating a public finance system.
You can't do that because of the interpretation that the Supreme Court has taken with respect to the First Amendment and freedom of speech as it attaches to corporations and these sources of big money. And even under some of the earlier cases that are out there, a mandatory system of public financing is probably elusive. But I think you can create a voluntary system of public financing that's attractive enough. The candidates will want to participate in it. You know, you create a multiple match. So for every dollar contributed in a grassroots donor category, you get a 5-to-1 match. So that's attractive to a candidate because they see that public money as being real and helping to underwrite the campaigns. You can build in a provision, as we're looking to do in legislation I'm working on now, that would say that if a super PAC comes into a race and drops a lot of money on that race, then it triggers an opportunity for the candidates who are affected to be able to go to a public fund and get some extra support to push back on that super PAC expenditure and to level the playing field a little bit, which, by the way, over time, I think, will create a deterrent effect on the super PACs in terms of getting in to these races. But it's all about completely changing the paradigm and putting the grassroots donor, the average citizen who can afford maybe $15, $20, $30 contribution, put them back in charge of the democracy, and you're going to see better results.
So, well, let me go back to the phone chairs. I have a question to push a little further, but 410-319-8888. Congressman John Sarbanes is in the House, and Travis, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I kind of want to get on the same track that the congressman was just on, and I hate to say it, but I do have to call him out on something. When he pointed out the polling regarding taxing hedge fund managers, I'll note you said the polling shows, you did not say I support, and I think that it kind of gets to the broader issue, which is I do agree that there is a need for campaign finance reform, but there's also a need for what is supposed to be the party of the left to start kind of endorsing those ideas to say, yes, we should tax hedge fund managers. Yes, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, GE, Citi, some of whom have a lot of kind of, you know, Citi is pretty well dug into the Democratic Party, as is GE, to say, yes, you should pay some taxes, not zero taxes, and to say most of all, and this was actually the original reason I was calling, that not only should we not make cuts to Social Security, that we should endorse expanding it because $14,000 to $18,000 is not enough for an adult to live on, and to say instead of making cuts to Medicare, to say we should expand Medicare to everyone because Medicare is the most efficient insurance system in the country. And what really troubles me, Congressman, is that you say, you know, you'll cite polling and you'll say, oh, well, it's hard to pass a law, and you get spun around. To put the law out there, you're a pretty famous dude. I mean, you're not the president, but you are a relatively famous Maryland figure. To have you wave that bill around and say, I'm going to tax corporations, I'm going to expand the social safety net and make your tax dollars work for you because the government works for everybody. Why won't you or anyone in your party put yourselves out on the line and represent the ideals that you're starting to get out there, but you're mainly just hemming and hawing around saying, well, the Republicans won't vote for it, so we're not going to propose it. Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, Travis.
Yeah, thanks, Travis. The reason I talked about the polling was I was trying to make the point that even though there's overwhelming public support for something, it's impossible to get that process because of the influence of big money. But I'm very happy to cite the fact that I'm one of a handful of members that's been an original co-sponsor of legislation. Peter DeFazio from Oregon tends to be the one who jumps out of the gate fastest on some of these things. But I've been an original co-sponsor with him of legislation that would take on the hedge funds. I'm an original co-sponsor with him of legislation that would put a transaction fee on Wall Street transactions. You could raise a tremendous amount of money that way in ways that wouldn't in any way impede Wall Street and what it's supposed to be doing out there, but could generate resources to help us fund the things that we care about, like education and health care and job-creating initiatives and so forth. I accept your point that in some ways, the Democratic Party has gotten co-opted by this big money culture as well. And it's just another reason why I want to see us remove the money and its influence on our political system.
Where are you, and Nancy coming up next, and then Bernard, but where are you with this, supporting or not supporting the efforts by some other members of Congress, and maybe you're already doing it, like Donna Edwards and some others around the country, who are pushing for an amendment to overturn Citizens United as a constitutional amendment?
I support that. And your next guest, Jamie Raskin, actually was able to garner signatures from 110 members of the Maryland General Assembly on a letter or declaration that was forwarded to Congress saying, we want you to pass the amendment in Congress, and we stand ready to pass it in the Maryland General Assembly. As you know, you need two-thirds in Congress to amend the Constitution, and you need three-quarters of state legislatures to do it,
right,
too. So it's a combination effort. Now, let me say this. I don't think you amend the Constitution every day. I mean, that's something – that's a big step
to years.
Do. But my point is the proposition of amending the Constitution is not something to be taken lightly. But in this instance – because I think the Supreme Court has gone so far beyond the pale, that response is warranted. And so I support these efforts to amend the Constitution. In fact, we had a big rally recently on Capitol Hill. Jamie Raskin was there with others from the state level to make this point. And it's a tough process. It takes a long time. But we ought to pursue it. It's a way to marshal the energy and frustration people have. The other two pieces of the tripod here are better disclosure and transparency so we know where the big money's coming from, and ultimately, I think, public financing of campaigns so we can remove the influence of that money altogether.
Let's go back to the phones. We have also one of our callers had to hang up but left his question, so I'll read that. 410-319-8888. Nancy, you're on the air.
Thank you. My name is Nancy Smith, and I am with the Maryland Food Bank. And on behalf of the Maryland Food Bank and probably over the 500,000 people, families that we serve, I just want to thank Congressman Sarbanes and his staff for always, keeping an open line of communication, supporting our efforts. And I see him frequently in the community going to events, and he has not forgotten what he was elected for, and he still has the constituency that he reaches out to, and we appreciate him. We're glad we're in the 3rd District, and I just want to say thank you, Congressman.
Well, I appreciate that very much. It does give me a thought when you talk about representing somebody or electing someone to represent you in Washington. One way to look at what's happening, Mark, is that when somebody goes into the voting booth and they pull that lever for you, they're saying, go to Washington and represent my interests, an average member of the public. What happens is, as soon as you arrive in Washington, these forces begin to conspire so that you will cease to represent the person who sent you there, and you will start representing instead the special interests. And one way to think of public financing, and certainly grassroots financing, is that when you cast that vote, if you also say, here's a $5 contribution, go do the right thing, then you're giving your representative the ability to basically sort of arm themselves against the influence of the special interest, because they don't need to be dependent on that to fund their campaigns. So what are you doing with that contribution? Or with public financing, you're protecting the franchise, which is under attack right now because of the disproportionate influence that these special interests have on our political system.
And it's true. I mean, well, let me come back to this. Let me get the callers, I promise. 410-319-8888. Bernard, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Mike, and Congressman. I sort of think outside the box. I always say it's not what they do. It's what we allow them to do as American people or as voters. So, and it leads to a whole lot of questions about we don't vote, we don't complain. They see what what they are doing to us as far as lawyers and don't pass the right bills or watered down bills, whether I get a chance to write the bills. I remember Bill Maher on Larry King's show said a couple of times, Americans are too dumb to go. So I don't know if that's true or not, but you know, a lot of things happen, especially take for instance Obamacare bill, where some of the states or some of the people want to do away with it. And on Rem Al Sharpton's show yesterday, he pointed out that Brown of Massachusetts, 23-year-old daughter, is still on his insurance policy. If that bill wasn't, Obamacare bill wasn't in effect, she wouldn't be on there at 23 years. So American people see what's going on, but they don't seem to do anything about it when it's time comes to vote or vote their interests in.
Well, I actually think Americans are smart. And what's happening is they're looking at the system and they're reaching the conclusion that their voice can't be heard anymore. When you look at someone like this fella from Las Vegas who poured $21 million of his own money into the presidential race on behalf of Newt Gingrich, and you then think to yourself, well, all I can manage to contribute is $15 or $20. You make the sound judgment that how can I compete? And what happens is that then leads to real deep cynicism on the part of the public. And I hear that every day as I move around my district. People are very cynical. They have a sense of helplessness about whether their voice can be heard anymore. And one of the wonderful things, Mark, of being able to say to them, we're doing this grassroots financing, is it's a way to say, you know what, let's try to fight back. Let's show that if 1,000 people or 5,000 people or 10,000 people link arms and give $10, $15, $20, $25, that begins, not right away, but over time, that can begin to compete with the power of the super PACs.
It also puts you at risk on some levels. I mean, if you can't raise the $500,000, you have to run your campaign on less than you think you need.
Well, that's why you build the multiple match in if you're going to design a public financing system. In other words, what I would propose in terms of legislation would be that if you raise $50,000 through grassroots donations, you get a 5-to-1 match. And actually, we're going to put another tier in that would say that if you commit not to take any donations above $100, like you really go all in, mm-hmm. you could get a 10-to-1 match. So that becomes real money to help underwrite your campaign. But it's also got to be designed in a practical way so that members of Congress and candidates who are used to the current system can begin to acclimate to a system that's a public financing system, and they choose to participate in it. I can tell you, Mark, that the great majority of my colleagues, if they could snap their fingers and get to a different way of financing campaigns, they'd do it in a second. But it's the getting from here to there that's the complicated part of it. Look, the statistics show that the average member of Congress is spending 30 to 70% of their time fundraising. We become professional fundraisers instead of public servants that are out, you know, up there to try to enact the public will through policy. And so we don't have time to do what we've been elected to do. And that's a travesty, and it doesn't meet the expectation of what the average person wants to see when they go in there and they pull the lever for their representative.
Congressman John Sarbanes, and we'll get to Celeste, the next caller. We'll come to you in a minute, but let me read this email. The piece came in, and let me just see what it says here. Bear with me one second. I got to pull it up. It says, question from caller. Where does John Sarbanes stand on Congress accepting health insurance like normal people and Social Security?
I'm for that, and that's the way it works right now. I mean, I participate in an insurance plan that is a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan under the Federal Employee Health Benefit Plan. So there's 2.5-3 million people across the country who are federal employees who have access to that plan. It's a pretty good plan. It's not particularly distinctive from a lot of other commercial plans that are out there that people have. So I think we ought to participate in the same way that the public does in the various options that are available, and that's the way it currently operates. And what was the other?
And Social Security. In other words,
and Social Security.
I think it's a retirement question he was asking.
Same thing. I mean, you know, when I turn 62, I hope to qualify for Social Security, assuming I've worked the requisite number of quarters, 40 quarters, which is the standard. I expect to do that. I think I've already done it, so I think I will qualify when I turn the right age. There's a lot of misinformation, by the way, out there about what congressional pensions are. You know, there's this notion that somehow you get elected and suddenly you're entitled to some full pay retirement. The fact of the matter is that most of the retirement that's available to members of Congress is in the form of contributing to a 401k type plan. We call it the thrift savings plan in the federal, you know, that's the federal option. But it's a 401k that you can contribute to, just like millions of Americans are contributing to their 401ks. And I mentioned, you know, at the beginning of the show that there's a lot of cynicism out there about Congress. Look, I get that. I come home every night. You know, I'm one of the few members who can get out of the bubble of Washington, D.C., get back home to my family, get back and talk to constituents. It's very healthy because you get that distance on the place and you can kind of put it in the right perspective. But I know that people are cynical and jaded about things. And the best way to cure that, Mark, is to get to a situation where we can go enact the public policy that people want to see. And what's standing in our way is the influence of this big money on the political system right now, and that's why we've got to address it.
410-319-8888. Celeste, you're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, Celeste.
My questions, I have two questions. Mr. Sarbanes, how long have you been in Congress?
I've been in there three terms, so I'm in my sixth year right now.
Okay. Didn't there used to be a law where the congressman or a representative couldn't take money from special interests and big companies?
Well, there's always been a law previously that you can't take money directly from, say, a corporation or a union or whatever. But what was created was this system of political action committees that are affiliated with these corporate interests or unions and so forth. And so they are in a position to make contributions to campaigns. So that creates the potential for real influence. And you have a system now that, again, where the institution of Congress is very highly dependent on PAC sources of funding. And that's why, you know, K Street has all these PACs and so forth. One of the proposals that I would like to see in any public financing legislation is that somebody who wants to get access to public money through a public financing system would have to decline PAC contributions. That would be one of the trade-offs, which I think makes sense, because if the public's going to step up and say, yes, we'll help underwrite your campaign, it's fair for the public to expect that you'll no longer take money from the PAC community.
I mean, and there are a few other congressmen I've heard talk about this, congressional representatives, not many. I mean, when Wayne Gilchrist, a Republican, was in the House, he would take no money outside his district from anyone, never take any PAC money, nor corporate money. He just made a decision that the only money I'll take is from people who live in my district.
Right.
And write a check.
Right. And he's no longer in Congress.
And he's no longer in Congress. He was beaten by big money.
There you go.
So there you go.
good point, Mark.
But no, I'm saying I found him to be, in my years covering politics,
let's create a system,
I know.
Right? Let's create a system that protects people like that, or supports, that's a better word, that supports people like that who want to stay true to the constituencies that sent them to Washington. And, you know, I look at this in many respects, like, let's create a system that can liberate members of Congress from the undue influence that these special interests currently have over them. They're not bad people. These are people that are trying to do their jobs. I mean, the great majority of my colleagues are folks that I'm very impressed with, and they're there for the right reasons. But they are being consumed by a system that forces them to spend a majority of their time raising money and creates this institutional dependency on special interests that frankly often have an agenda that is different from what the public wants to see. And it's not fair to ask good people to go serve in Congress and be subjected to that kind of system. So let's create a system of public financing that can free them from that dependency, and it'll be better all around.
Congressman John Sarbanes represents the 3rd Congressional District. He's a Democrat. As he said, he's been in Congress almost 6 years. And you're running for another term?
I am. I'm running for another term this year. So I hope for people's support in that.
And we'll have him back on between now and then and more to talk about issues facing America. This hour was really dedicated to what he's been saying about money and politics. And that's one of the conversations we've had on the show a great deal for a long time. And we have to continue that discussion if you want to keep our democracy strong and safe. So I want to thank you for being here.
Thanks very much, Mark.
When we take a break here, we're going to come back and we'll be joined by State Senator Jamie Raskin and Daphne Weisham from IPS. We'll be here in Baltimore this weekend to talk about how they can we can create a new economy. Then we'll be talking with Jeffrey Schwartz, director of this incredible film, Veto, talking about the end of the show. On our way out of here, I want to remind you that the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by Urbanite Magazine and his new e-zines. And Urbanite's Healthy Food Series is coming up. The Urbanite Healthy Food Film Series, part of the 2012 Urbanite Project, continues this weekend. The second movie, Urban Roots, covers the growing urban farming movement in Detroit and will be screened at 2640 Space this Friday, May the 4th at 6 p.m. That's Urban Roots this Friday night at 2640 Space on St. Paul Street, 2640 St. Paul. More information available at urbanlightproject.com. We'll be right back. Stay with us.